Hello, welcome to Bare Naked Politics. This is the podcast for people who want to keep up with the news, but who aren't necessarily politics experts. So it's okay if you feel a bit left out of that conversation, and if you think certain media outlets that we won't mention are a bit guilty of overcomplicating things or making them a bit dry. I understand where you're coming from, and I'm here to rectify that. I'm Julia Bell, and I'm going to walk you through this big story for the day slash week slash the rest of time, which is the climate, and more specifically, COP26, this huge conference all around the climate and the environment and addressing the climate crisis. And it's happening in Glasgow at the end of October. And it's one of these things, everyone who is everyone in terms of world leaders and decision makers is pretty much going to be there. So it is kind of a big deal that we are hosting it here in the UK, in Scotland. Actually, I say everyone's going to be there. There's a couple of key leaders that aren't, and we'll talk about them properly in a second. But also, the Queen is not going to be there. For health reasons, she's been advised to, I suppose, rest and not make the trip. And I'm going to make the leap in assuming that she's actually genuinely gutted about that, because she has been, lately, I would say, more and more vocal about how much of a priority the climate is to her. And it's quite unusual, right? The Queen's not meant to have political opinions. If you've watched The Crown, then you'll know that this is something, because The Crown is gospel, right? And you'll know that this is something that's very important, that the monarchy don't share their political opinions. But very recently, when the Queen was at this event in Wales, she was filmed. So it's, you know, it's not rumour. You can see her lips saying it. She was filmed saying the words, and I'll quote here, "It's really irritating when they talk, but they don't do." And in that instance, I'm informed that she was talking about the climate. She was talking about these world leaders who, I suppose, in her view, are not doing enough. So there you go. A bit of rare insight into the Queen's opinions, which we don't usually hear about. But either way, she's not going to be there. Right. So why is it called such a tangent? Why is it called COP26? Weirdly, that's like the most regular question that I've been asked about this. And it's quite simple to answer. COP stands for Conference of the Parties, COP. And the parties aren't, you know, Labour and the Conservatives. It's the parties are all of these various countries. They are the parties taking part in this big summit. And UN members and so on that are hopefully going to come together and agree, for God's sake, please, on a plan of action to tackle this issue. So COP, Conference of the Parties, and 26, because it's the 26th of these events. And there's one every year, except of course last year because of the pandemic. And yeah, COP25 was in 2019, of course. It was in Madrid, in Spain. COP24 was in Katowice, in Poland. Is that how you pronounce it? Who knows? Katowice. But this one's in Glasgow. And that does mean that all eyes are on us and on our leaders to set a good example, which, are they doing that? Not sure. We'll talk about that in the podcast. And look, on this climate stuff, you know that I'm a political junkie and I'm across that side of it. But in terms of, you know, environmental, academic, scientific sides of things, I am not your gal by any means. So in this episode, I'll be talking to Alice Shelton, who is going to offer lots of clarity. Alice is doing a PhD assessing the value for money in reducing our CO2 emissions. So in other words, how can we achieve our climate goals and not bankrupt ourselves? And if you listen to what the government are proposing in terms of rectifying our carbon emissions, people like Alice are very, very important. So she's one of these clever souls trying to find solutions for all this stuff.
Quicker we bite the bullet and accept that we're already in this process. Even if we completely stopped emitting carbon today, the Earth would continue to increase in temperature. We would still continue to see an increase in extreme weather events. So by prolonging that, it's not going to get any better.
That's Alice's voice. You'll hear lots from her later on. And she's doing this PhD at the University of Strathclyde. So she is literally down the road from where the conference will be in Glasgow, Scotland. So lots to get through in this episode. Make sure you're subscribed to the podcast. And if you're listening on Spotify, you will see this little bell next to where it says follow. Click on that. And that means you'll get notified every time a new episode goes up. All right, let's get you across COP26. So like I say, it's a United Nations Climate Summit, or a UN Climate Conference, if you want. And according to the official COP26 website, and I'll quote from it now, more than 190 world leaders are expected to arrive in Scotland, together with tens of thousands of negotiators, government representatives, businesses and citizens for 12 days of talks. So it's starting on Halloween, 31st of October, and I believe it's carrying on until the 12th of November. And incidentally, Airbnbs in Glasgow and all the hotels are making a killing, apparently. You might have seen news stories sort of trickling around the fringes talking about how, you know, Airbnb hosts are charging, I mean, really insulting prices for people like journalists and activists who aren't made of money to come and stay in the city and cover this conference. So I don't know. I don't know whether that's exploitative or just good business, but I suppose speaking as a woman of Glaswegian stock, if you've ever followed my Instagram, you'll know, because my parents haven't lost their accents. I can't help but feel quite excited that there's going to be lots of money pumped into the place. Anyway, what, I hear you ask, will all the leaders be talking about at this conference? And like I said in the intro, essentially the bottom line is, how do we avoid irreversibly warming the planet? And once we've arrived at the how, we need to put a plan together where each country holds the other accountable in actually sticking to it. That, if we can come up with something, will be a successful COP26. And so a big part of that, for example, is reaching net zero.
We need to, as many people as possible to agree to go to net zero so that they're not producing too much carbon dioxide by the middle of the century. Now, I think it can be done. It's going to be very, very tough, this summit, and I'm very worried because it might go wrong, and we might not get the agreements that we need, and it's touch and go.
There you go, Prime Minister Boris Johnson explaining the net zero goal to a group of school children. They kind of had this children's version of a climate press conference, and while I think that's a lovely idea, it wasn't particularly fun listening to our own Prime Minister say to a group of children whose responsibility it is going to be to look after the planet when we're all gone, it's not fun to listen to him say we might not manage to have a successful agreement at COP26. You know, having him say that to a group of children, I don't know, there was something I found really disturbing about that. And with the urgency of this thing, you know, I said that there are COPs every year, but most climate scientists are saying you really need to sort this thing out now, or else it'll be too, I mean, yesterday, really, but you've got to do it at this one in October, because it's a kind of do or die. That's the impression I'm getting from a lot of the leading thinkers in this arena. And there's one particular climate activist who has quite clearly had enough of all the promises and all the chat, and she wants to see drastic action immediately.
Build back better, blah, blah, blah. Green economy, blah, blah, blah. Net zero by 2050, blah, blah, blah. Net zero, blah, blah, blah. Climate neutral, blah, blah, blah. Our hopes and dreams drown in their empty words and promises. There is no planet B. There is no planet blah, 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 blah.
Greta Thunberg at the Youth for Climate Conference, and it's unmistakable, those phrases she was using, build back better, green economy, net zero by 2050, those are specifically UK policies. Those are our Prime Minister's slogans, and they're not paraphrased. She just lifted them from his speeches and then kind of tarnished them all. So she's not pretending at all to approve of what our leader's doing. But I suppose people with a particularly low bar, they might look at our leader and say, well, at least he's going to the summit, which is something that the people of China are not at liberty to say. This week, and I'm recording on the 28th of October, the Chinese leader, Xi Jinping, announced that he's not coming. He's just not coming to COP26, which isn't great because China is the world's largest greenhouse gas emitter. It's number one on the list. They have, you know, submitted certain things. It's not as if they're ignoring it altogether. They've set, for instance, a target of reaching net zero by 2060, which is a decade later than the pledge made by the likes of us in the UK and the US. We've said 2050 is our goal to reach net zero. But just having China sort of set targets and submit a vague plan in the form of documents isn't enough, according to most people, including myself. You know, I think most of us want every single leader, especially the ones that have a massive impact on the climate, to be there in person. You know, politics is very personal. And the biggest breakthroughs in terms of peace and in terms of progress are made in person. If you think about wars and if you think about progress, those have quite often just come to an end because you got the people in charge in the same room to humanize each other and to shake hands and to come up with a solution. And sadly, it seems that the approach between China and the rest of the attending countries is just going to be, you know, via documents, which isn't particularly personal at all. Not to mention Russia as well. The president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, he's not going to be there either. So these are big countries, you know, and their commitment, if you like, is integral if we want to actually manage this on a global scale. But I think, sadly, geopolitics has fucked that up. You know, Russia and China are not great friends by any means of the US and the UK. And both sides have been increasingly guilty for jabbing at each other and making these very thinly veiled threats militarily, financially. And in no way is that helping the global effort towards the climate. And I think, God, climate activists especially will be screaming because this problem is bigger than any one person or any one government. The planet doesn't care if we disagree with each other's politics. The sea levels aren't interested in our kind of economic battles or our military egos. This is not relevant. I think when you listen to this stuff, you just want to knock their heads together sometimes. All right, speaking of not agreeing with each other's politics, you do not have to go all the way to Russia or all the way to China to find people who don't necessarily see eye to eye with Boris Johnson on the climate. In fact, you literally just have to pop next door from his own office to number 11 Downing Street. That's where Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, is based. And of course, being Chancellor means he is in charge of the money and of the economy for this country. So it's Sunak's job to work out where it's spent and where it's saved. And I mean, of course, it's understandable that Rishi Sunak has had his plate absolutely overflowing because of the pandemic and trying to fish us out of untold amounts of debt because of the furlough scheme and all the borrowing and whatnot. But again, the planet doesn't care that we're in debt. So it's not going to wait for us to get, you know, our ducks in a row. In fact, all the ducks will be dead by the time we can line them up. Sorry, that's such a dark joke. I don't even know where that came from. But I think that onlookers will... Sorry, I've just got in my head all these dead ducks in a row. I can't concentrate on what I'm saying. But I think onlookers will have watched sort of Sunak's speech, especially talking about the budget this week, and they'll have watched his speech at the Conservative Party conference, and they will be scratching their heads going, why is he not talking about the climate really at all? I mean, at the party conference at the beginning of October, he did not mention the climate once in his speech. And then the budget that he announced this week on the 27th of October, the environment came up, but it took an absolute backseat. And in fact, a lot of commentators are saying, well, this is no accident. It's not that he's forgetting to mention it. It's absolutely intentional because he knows, Rishi Sunak knows better than anybody, the actual costs of moving an entire economy to be completely carbon neutral. His team of kind of economic boffins in the Treasury will have more than likely run the numbers multiple times for what a net zero UK looks like and what it costs to get there. And what do you know? It'll be eye-wateringly expensive, regardless of what Boris Johnson says. So I think a lot of commentators are saying perhaps Rishi Sunak isn't so hot on talking about the climate because he doesn't want to spook us as to how much it might hurt our bank accounts, us being the public. Still, though, I mean, this isn't ideal for a Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who is pretty heavy going when it comes to talking about the climate. He makes these big sweeping promises about, I mean, you've heard it all, building this new green economy. We're going to create all these job opportunities because of it. And, you know, this net zero target is absolutely the be all and end all. And he talks about moving from fuel to electric, investment in new technologies, blah, blah, blah. You've heard it. Blah, 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 as Greta Thunberg would say. But it is quite a different narrative between the two people, the Prime Minister and the Chancellor, who are meant to be working together on this stuff. It's as if they're talking about different governments and different aims. And I know that it's a tale as old as time to have the PM making promises and then the Treasury and the Chancellor sort of banging their heads on the wall in despair because they're thinking, how the fuck are we going to pay for this? But in this instance, even though this is a usual conflict between these two departments, it is as if Boris Johnson is floating on this sea of never-ending cash that he like can't wait to spend on the environment, and Sunak is sort of looking after the pennies. In fact, in Sunak's budget, not only did he not really talk about the environment a huge amount, he actually talked about kind of environmentally damaging policies. For instance, he talked about slashing air passenger duty for domestic flights, basically making it cheaper to fly around the UK. And that's what, 4 days, 3 days before we have a climate summit where we're getting everybody to come here to talk about how important it is that we slash our carbon emissions. This is not the vibe that the likes of Greta Thunberg will be, you know, excited about. And you might say that since we're hosting the thing, we really ought to at least make out like it's one of our top priorities. All right, I think that's enough of me and the politics stuff. Let's hear from Alice. Alice Shelton, like I say, she's doing a PhD in the ways that we can lower our carbon emissions in a more cost-effective way, which is absolutely perfect, right? It's vital work because the whole balance, the whole struggle that I've just outlined is between the things we need to do and the money that we don't have to do it. I feel like Rishi Sunak would hug Alice if he knew about the work she was doing. And she was very good at explaining the sort of scientific implications of all of this stuff. So have a listen to our chat. Although I'll mention now, you'll probably hear it in my voice, I started off a little bit alarmed because when I opened the call, somebody with a completely different name to Alice's joined in, and Beatrice something, I think it was. So I had absolutely no idea what was going on with that, and it did turn out to be her. Have a listen and you'll understand.
Hello.
Hi.
I just realised my friend used my Zoom, so the name is completely wrong, so that probably confused you a lot.
Who am I doing an interview with?
Yes.
All right, so considering your studies and your work, you are the best person to ask this question, which is, what is the current picture with the climate today? In other words, how bad actually is it?
Well, I suppose for the human population, it's pretty much as bad as it's ever been. It's not getting any better in terms of the climate that we live in. So the extremes of weather, living with higher droughts, higher rainfall, ice melt, increased sea level rise. And that comes, yes, from ice melting, but also from warmer temperatures and the ocean swelling almost. Also increased extreme weather events like hurricanes and typhoons. All of that costs money. So although, yeah, it's going to be very expensive and we need to invest an awful lot of money into reaching net zero and reducing our emissions, the longer that we wait to do that, the more money we're wasting in flood defences, in rebuilding communities and buildings and infrastructure that's being destroyed through flooding and all of these kind of increased natural weather events. So, yeah, it's not great.
And you're kind of seeing it as a, this is inevitable money that we have to spend, and actually spending it now might hurt, but it's only going to hurt more the longer we wait. So even economically, this is the only sensible course of action. That's your kind of view on this?
I think so, definitely. Yeah, the quicker we bite the bullet and accept that we're already in this process, even if we completely stopped emitting carbon today, the Earth would continue to increase in temperature. We would still continue to see an increase in extreme weather events. So by prolonging that, it's not going to get any better.
Wow. So you're saying that, you know, even if every country reached net zero literally tomorrow, the planet would keep warming to some degree. But the number that everyone is very wary of is this all-important 1.5 degrees. I think there's an idea that, yes, we can warm the planet a bit, but if we go above that 1.5 degrees mark, then, you know, as an average kind of increase in the global temperature, then we are supposedly in big trouble. What is the relevance of that number, that 1.5 degrees?
Yeah, so I think that is it's something that's achievable. I think that is why 1.5 degrees was decided upon. It's something that is realistic, hopefully, in terms of financial investment. But we're currently at 1.02 degrees of warming, I think, since the records began. So we've got about 0.5 degrees leeway to reach that. So yeah, 1.5 degrees is something, it's seen as, I suppose, a livable index. If we reach, or we will inevitably reach 1.5 degrees, but that is still livable. It's not going to be entirely worse than it is now. Whereas 2 degrees, 3 degrees, you get into situations where communities simply can't live where they currently do. And obviously that is going to lead to other problems, water wars, people, very, very dense populations. With the COVID pandemic, we've seen how dense populations, how easy it is for things like that to spread. So ultimately 1.5 degrees allows us to continue to live, I suppose, in a society that we're almost used to now. The more that grows, we're not necessarily going to become extinct overnight, but it puts an awful lot more pressure on us as a species.
It's crazy because 1.5 degrees seems like nothing. You know, if you're today, for example, if you look at the weather forecast and it says it's going to be 11 degrees and tomorrow is going to be 12.5, I don't feel like I would walk outside and think, oh my God, it's boiling out here. It's completely different to yesterday. It's such a kind of marginal difference. And yet it's essentially being painted as life and death for an overall planetary kind of rate of warmth.
Absolutely. But I think it was so much of that comes into weather systems. You know, like we have the Gulf Stream that keeps the UK relatively warm compared to our latitudinal counterparts. So things like that would pause or slow. So we would end up being much, much colder, which again impacts the way that we live. So it's 1.5 degrees, yes, on a general scale to us looking at the weather every day doesn't seem like an awful lot, but on a global scale, that's massive.
It's all quite bleak talking about this stuff. I don't know how you study it all the time. And also, it's so ominous, the fact that you're basically pedaling away, trying to solve real life problems. But still, at the end of the day, all of these decisions are in the hands of people that we've never met. These leaders are going to all sit in this summit and talk about things that are going to affect all of us. So when it comes to COP26, this global environmental summit, in your view, what bottom line absolutely needs to be agreed on? What would a successful COP26 look like in your view?
I think the key thing for me is the financing. I think that, so between 2015 and 2020, the nations that signed the Paris Agreement have also committed to investing $100 billion per year into Green Climate Fund. We currently have $9 billion in that. So it's been massively underfunded, and that is a commitment that was also made.
And what is this fund for specifically?
It's for, a lot of it is to actually help developing countries decarbonize. So it's developed countries are paying into this Green Climate Fund to help developing countries decarbonize and also improve their infrastructure, so sea level defenses and things like that, because of like the inevitable change that we will see. So for me, it's accepting the cost. It's for them. And obviously I think this was hopefully gonna, you know, happen and be a bit of a kick up the bum in terms of just accept it, we're gonna have to spend the money. Whereas obviously with the COVID pandemic, and so many countries have spent billions of dollars, pounds, euros, whatever it is, in keeping their countries up and running during a global pandemic and furloughing staff, all of that sort of thing, it's really going to take a hit. So I think that was one aim that was hoped to be achieved that probably won't be, and probably won't be for a couple of years while we're still dealing with that. But again, like I said, the longer it takes, the more investment that's going to be anyway. I think as well, it's just, it's maintaining communications. Like, COP happens every single year. Obviously it didn't last year because of COVID. But I think it's good to keep that momentum. People like Putin isn't coming. Russia is the fourth highest emitter in the world. That shouldn't be optional. Like, yeah. Even if you're not willing to travel, tune in. Like, you should be part of, tune in, zoom in. Like,
yeah.
Be part of the communications. Be a global citizen in that sense. You've chosen to be a country's leader. So take some responsibility in that sense as well.
If the government were to effectively cut down our CO2, if they were actually able to meet or, you know, supersede their promise that we will be carbon neutral net zero by 2050, what in your view would life look like? Like, oh, we live in a net zero country. How would life be different in that versus the reality that we have now, do you think?
I know Boris Johnson doesn't want to admit that life is going to have to change. There was talk of like a tax on eating meat and the frequent flyer status being swiped off, and that was removed. So things like that, in my opinion, have to happen. We do need to eat less meat. We do need to use more public transport, and we do need to cycle more, walk more, be a bit more, what's the word? Dependent on lower carbon strategies. Eating more seasonally, which I mentioned, things like don't expect strawberries in the winter. Like, things like that are going to have to happen. There's a lot of investment going into electric planes, hydrogen fuel planes. They're going to be short haul. So, you know, going to Europe in the summer and things, that might not be an issue. But long haul flights, there's sustainable aviation fuels that are being looked at and invented and researched that might enable us to fly long haul. I'm sure all of these things will come about. But it's time, and it's whether, I suppose, as a society, we're able and willing to make some short-term loss for long-term gain.
Especially when you're talking about lifetimes as well. Like, you know, something that I've imagined is in 150 years, we actually crack the ability to fly around without it emitting carbon and, you know, contributing to global warming. But I'll be dead by then. So it's not, it's a kind of unfairness piece, isn't there? The generations before us got to fly around all they wanted. The generations after us may well be able to, because that technology would have arrived, but we've fallen in this awkward bracket where we have to make all these fucking sacrifices.
No, and I think you're right. And I think that can be probably the most demotivating factor, because people are just like, God, we walk around saying you only live once, YOLO, like... You know, make, like, live your best life, do whatever you can. And unfortunately, that might mean that we have to make some sacrifices. But then think about our grandparents and going through the war and living on rations and, you know, not having cars to drive and living in smog-filled cities in the winter and coal fireplaces and all of these things that we now don't have to live with and take for granted. So I think there is... Yes, it might seem that generationally we were born at the wrong time, but there has been an awful lot of sacrifices in generations gone past. And ultimately, we still have an awful lot of comforts to be grateful for, I think.
I love that attitude. I'm going to try and remember that. And I now feel bad. So you had to bring the war into it, didn't you? Can I ask you kind of a... just a terminology question, because I see this word more and more when I'm reading articles and things. What does the term greenwashing mean? If somebody greenwashes something, what are they doing?
So that is basically when a company claims that what they're doing is going to benefit the environment, society. It doesn't always have to be reduced carbon emissions. It can bring in like human rights and things like that as well. So they make out that what they're doing is conscious, like environmentally or ethically humanly, yeah, conscious, and it's not. It might be one aspect of it. I think probably a good example is like biodegradable packaging. So yes, they might be made out of like plant starches, mushrooms, pulp, all of that sort of thing, but they have to be degraded in very specific environments. They can't be recycled, so you can't put them in your plastic recycling. If you put them in general waste, they end up in landfill like everything else. They have to be composted, and that means really high pressure and high temperatures, which we don't have. We don't have an awful lot. We don't have, there are some plants in the UK, but we don't have access to them in every city. So that is probably a good example of greenwashing. You think, oh, it's a biodegradable cup for the top of my coffee. It doesn't help.
Wow. Wow.
More doom and gloom. Julia, I'm really sorry. No, all of these things can happen.
But is it doom and gloom in that sense? I mean, some of the stuff we've talked about is incredibly doom and gloom, but that, I think, is actually just how to be a savvy consumer.
Exactly that.
Do you feel, truly, do you feel hopeful or do you feel hopeless? About the climate, I'm not asking about, you know, your...
not my mental health.
Maybe do another podcast.
No, it's a really good question. So I suppose how I ended up where I am doing a PhD, I originally studied marine biology and I really enjoyed the research side of things, really enjoyed doing my master's research, wanted to do a PhD, but honestly just needed some time out from academia. That was meant to be a year, it turned into six. And in that time, I worked as a dive instructor and I saw more coral bleaching, more algal growth, less fish diversity, just from diving the same dive sites week in, week out.
Wow, and that's just in 6 years.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously other pressures on a small island community, but a lot of it can be attributed to climate change and ocean warming and increase in storms and rainfall, all of that sort of thing. And I didn't want to just document like coral cover, for example, and be like, yeah, over the last 10 years it's decreased, but we're not doing anything about it. I wanted to kind of be part of finding a solution and working within even a smaller community and changing that small community. If everybody did that, we wouldn't be in the issue that we are now. So although it is, like we've talked about, it is quite doom and gloom, it can seem like that, but there's also an awful lot of opportunities.
I feel like the fact that you're working towards solutions makes me think that you've got some hope, because otherwise you just wouldn't bother. I literally wouldn't, there would be no point.
But also, like, I absolutely love the natural world. Like, I love David Attenborough documentaries on BBC, things like that. Like, why would we not want to look after the planet?
I like that. I like that. That's a good place to end. Well, listen, Alice, thank you. That was really, really helpful. And keep doing what you're doing. If you could solve the whole climate change thing before 2050, that would be great.
It'd be great.
and if while you're there, you could get another PhD in finding this carbon neutral flight, long haul flight. I'm particularly keen on that idea.
I'm right there with you. Absolutely. Caribbean beaches and pina coladas.
Exactly. Let me know how you get on with that research. All right. That was Alice Shelton doing her PhD at the University of Strathclyde. What a human. We need more people like that. Thank you, Alice, for taking the time. And I think that's a good place to leave the whole episode. I think you've got a lot of the answers and the information in place for you to follow this event as it unfolds. And like I say, COP26 is happening from the 31st of October. Pretty much everyone is going to be there, except for China, Russia and the Queen, for different reasons. You know now what to look out for and what needs to be agreed on in order for us to make progress with this very looming climate issue. And if you like, I could do a follow-up, perhaps with Alice, if she's up for it, sort of after the conference has come to a close, and we can see where we stand from there, and if we think, you know, these leaders have done enough to get us out of this mess. So if that sounds helpful, just get in touch with me. You can message me on social media at @JuliaBell_X. Let me know if you'd like that. And just generally, if you do like these podcasts, if you find them helpful, please leave them a 5-star review. Say something nice, because that, especially the 5 stars, that helps me move up the homepage of whatever podcast platform you're using. And in turn, more people can find me, so I can help more people navigate this politics stuff. So if you're listening on particularly Apple Podcasts, say something nice, give me a 5-star review. And if you want to help this podcast keep going, the way to do that is to become a patron. It's a lovely community, costs the same as about a cup of coffee a month, and you get lots of bonus content too. All right, that's all for me this week. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you're doing well. I know it's a bit doom and gloom, but at least there's bits of optimism in there. Hopefully we'll have good news to report from after the event. Let's see. I'm not gonna get my ducks in a row just yet, my dead ducks. All right, I'll speak to you in the next one. Bye.